Lecture 16. Dong Zhongshu and Gi Hong, Eclecticism.
Hello again. In this lecture, we'll once again be talking about the convergence of empire and thought, how political situations shape philosophy, and then what happens when the political foundation that gave rise to a philosophy or supported a philosophy collapses. Okay. Confucianism became the official ideology of Imperial China during the Han Dynasty, from 202 BC to 220 AD. During this time, it was transformed from a movement that was focused on traditional culture and ethics to one that included cosmological speculations. Many of these ideas originated in the Hundred Schools, so you may be familiar with them from that lecture. Do you remember the naturalists? In Chinese, this is known as the Yin Yang School. These theorists, sometimes allied with the Taoists, saw the world as composed of two complementary opposite forces, which are ever shifting in an ebb and flow manner, right? Yin and Yang. The I Ching, or the Classic of Change, one of the five Confucian classics, was actually a divination text anciently. It used 64 hexagrams, so those are all the possible combinations of six broken or unbroken lines, and that eventually came to be understood in the Han Dynasty as representing a comprehensive model of being and change. So it's not just a predictor of the future, but it's actually a guide for the present as you try to understand what the present situation is like and then what it's likely to turn into and how you should behave in appropriate ways to that. Other thinkers tried to categorize natural and human phenomena in terms of the five phases. That's fire, metal, wood, earth, and water. Now, that sounds a little bit like the five elements in ancient Greek thought, but these aren't elements because they transform into each other. It was thought that these five phases succeed each other in a regular pattern of conquest. And once again, these aren't things, but they're sort of aspects within things. So the conquest cycle is water is conquered by earth, right? So you could build dikes or dams to control water. And earth is conquered by wood. And here you have to think of like a wooden plow that's cutting through the soil. Wood, in turn, is conquered by metal, as an axe cuts down a tree. And then fire conquers metal as it melts it. And then finally, fire is conquered by water. And then you're back again to the beginning of the cycle. It goes around and around. Eventually, each of these five phases came to be associated with a particular season or color or planet or a compass direction, though there's only four of those, so one of them doesn't quite match up. Or they were associated with a particular number or an internal organ of the body or some type of animal. For example, fire was connected with summer and with the color red. Okay, that sort of makes sense. It was also associated with the direction south and with the planet Mars, maybe. It was also connected with the number seven, with the heart, and with feathered creatures. And here it gets sort of speculative, I guess. It was also associated with the Zhou Dynasty. Each of the dynasties is associated with a phase that seemed to be dominant at that time. And this is where it really gets interesting. The Qin Dynasty, under the first emperor, had conquered the Zhou. So the first emperor of Qin proclaimed that his new dynasty ruled by the power of water, which had overcome fire. And water was correlated with winter, with the color black, and with the number six. Therefore, the first emperor changed the date when New Year occurred to the 10th month, so it's at the beginning of winter. He ruled harshly, which was a characteristic associated with those terms. He dressed his officials in black. He put black flags and black banners around his court. He rode a carriage with six horses, and he divided his empire into 36 commanderies. Remember, those are like provinces. And 36, of course, is 6 times 6. So he's got all of this numerological stuff going. Now, notice that he bases his claim to legitimacy on natural processes rather than on morality or on the mandate of heaven. He says, I'm ruling because I'm in accord with the cycles of the heavens and the earth. Later, philosophers argued for a different cycle called the production cycle, that fire gave rise to earth in ash, and earth produces metal, because you have to dig metal out of the ground, Metal produces water. I think what they were thinking of was the way if you lay a piece of metal out overnight, dew forms on it from condensation. And then water produces wood, right? And then wood produces fire, and then it goes around. And it all gets sort of confusing. There are different ways of figuring out how all this interacts. But it does extend itself to careful observation of nature and natural processes. But it's not exactly modern science. And the goal is to fit phenomena into these pre-existing categories, into these sort of pigeonholes, rather than establishing direct cause and effect. When Liu Bang overthrew the Qin dynasty and founded his own Han dynasty about 200 BC, Taoism enjoyed prominence. I mean, people were pretty tired of the activist, a harsh government of the legalists. They were looking for something a little more laid back and relaxed. But Confucianism still made some progress. The banning of the books that the first emperor had put into place was lifted. Some Confucian scholars were employed at court, including Lu Jia, who famously told Liu Bang that although he'd won the empire on horseback, he couldn't rule it on horseback. There's a different skill set from being a conqueror and then being a ruler. There was also a Confucian scholar named Xu Sun Tong, who set up the court rituals for him. The story is that after Liu Bang had combined all of China into one rule, his old generals, who now don't have much to do, sit around the palace, they're drinking, they're causing problems, they're hacking up pillars with their swords. And Xu Sun Tong goes to Liu Bang and says, I could set up a court ritual for you. And Liu Bang says, okay, but don't make it too complicated, not too hard. I hate that sort of stuff. But Xu Sun Tong gives everybody ranks. He lines everybody up, and according to ranks, they all have to go in and pay their respects to the emperor in order and then back out in regular manner. And Liu Bang says, ah, now I know what it's really like to be an emperor. So Confucians were useful after all, even if Liu Bang had shown his disdain for them previously. The stories are that when Liu Bang would meet a Confucian scholar, he was a man of war and action. He thought the Confucians were sort of wimps and bookish kind of things. The Confucian scholars would wear these very distinctive hats, and Liu Bang would grab off the hat of a Confucian scholar and then urinate into it to show how much he respected Confucianism. But things start to change. It was the Emperor Wu, however, and he lives from 156 to 87 BC. He's the one who really makes Confucianism official by putting in place some educational reforms. This is actually the same guy that Sima Qian ran into problems with. Emperor Wu is harsh, he has an aggressive rule, but he appoints erudite scholars in each of the five Confucian classics. They're like professorships. That happens in 136 BC, and then 12 years later, Emperor Wu founds an imperial academy that's devoted to the study of those Confucian classics, and that enrolls some 3,000 students eventually. These policies that Emperor Wu put into place were undertaken on a recommendation from Dong Zhengshu, who was also one of Sima Qian's teachers. Dong Zhengshu is the one who combines traditional Confucian moralism with cosmological speculations, and he's going to be our first great mind for this lecture. He lived from 195 to 105 BC. Dong Zhengshu was an advisor and a prime minister to Emperor Wu. He was probably the greatest of the Han Dynasty Confucian philosophers. He wrote a book called The Luxuriant Dew of the Spring and Autumn Annals. It has something to do with that Confucian classic. And this text tended toward comprehensiveness and synthesis and unity. I mean, he's bringing all sorts of ideas together, which was appropriate for a vigorous, expanding empire that's bringing all kinds of things together. Dong Zhengshu found hidden meaning in texts like the Spring and Autumn Annals. I mean, he thought that heaven worked through historical events, so you can study those and learn something about the cosmos. And Dong Zhengshu was famous for how diligently he studied. Sima Qian reports that Dong, this is his old teacher, for 3 years didn't even take time to look out at his garden. He's so engrossed, engaged in this study. Dong Zhengshu argued that heaven, earth, and man were intimately connected through correlative resonances. So this is based on numbers and yin-yang and the five phases. And he also proposed a microcosmic, macrocosmic model of the universe. For example, he says that the human body is a miniature cosmos. According to Dong Zhengshu, your 366 smaller joints match the days of the year. The 12 larger joints correspond to the months. The five major internal organs, that are also associated with the five phases. Those reflect, as I said, the five phases. And then the four limbs are like the four seasons. So your front is yang, your back is yin, but also the upper half of your body is yang and the lower half is yin. There's some overlapping in these categories. But that last one is kind of interesting because round is the shape of heaven and square is the shape of earth, which is why people alone among animals walk upright, right? Because your head is kind of round and it matches heaven and your feet are kind of square and they match earth. There are also carriages in Han Dynasty China that had a sort of square carriage body and then a round canopy over the top. And you may have seen Chinese coins that are round coins with square holes in the middle. Okay, the holes are really convenient because you can string a cord through them and you won't lose loose change. But also, those round coins with the square holes are going to represent heaven and earth together. All right. Is all of this kind of silly? Not exactly. I mean, his idea is that everything is related to everything else, so that the universe becomes one organic entity. And he looks at some evidence that almost seems scientific. He is really impressed by the phenomena of musical resonance. So, for example, if you've got a violin and you play a D string on the violin, make that sound. If there's another violin in the room, even if no one's around there, when you play that D string, the D string on that other violin will start to vibrate. Okay. Now, we know it's because of sound waves and stuff, but for Dong Zhongshu, he just noticed that things that are similar, of a similar nature, tend to be connected, even though there's no direct connection that you can see visibly. So in the same way, he said that portents and omens, like eclipses and heat waves and floods and earthquakes, those are all natural rather than supernatural. That behaviors and actions in the human world will have a natural resonance with things in nature. This is kind of, he's trying to provide a rational scientific basis for morality. Watch how Dong Zhongshu gets back to Confucian principles from cosmological theories. I'll give you a quote here. The greatest aspect of heaven's way lies in yin and yang. Yang constitutes virtue and yin constitutes punishment. Punishment presides over death and virtue presides over life. Therefore, yang always accompanies the vast summer and devotes itself to matters of birth, growth, nourishment, and maturation. Yin always occupies the vast winter and accumulates in vacant and useless places. Okay, so far you're probably dozing off here, but here's the kicker. Here's what I want. From this, one can see that heaven relies on virtue and does not rely on punishment, okay, because heaven is associated with yang. And he's back to Confucius's ideas. Remember that Confucius didn't like government by law so much as government by moral example. And that's the example that heaven is showing. It relies on virtue and does not rely on punishment. So the ruler is like heaven, and his ministers are like earth. There's a connection. An effective emperor ruling in accordance with natural processes can bridge the divide between heaven and earth. The Chinese character for king, it's Wang. It's actually the same Wang that occurs in so many Chinese surnames. That's written with three horizontal lines and then a vertical line that joins them. And when Dong Zhongshu looks at that character, he adds his own sort of moralistic interpretation, cosmological interpretation. He says it's like heaven on the top and earth on the bottom and man in the middle. And the ruler, the king, is the one that's going to join those all together, heaven, earth, and man. He also developed some ideas from Mencius. Now, do you remember Mencius talked about how goodness was innate in people? Human nature was good. Dong Zhongshu also believed that moral principles came from nature, that heaven provides a model for human action. Dong believed that this heaven and earth model should be operative in three key relationships. Emperors rule over ministers, as heaven sort of looks over earth, fathers over sons, and husbands over wives. Dong Zhongshu's philosophy fit the times because it offered a rationale for strong, centralized rule. And like the empire, it brings together diverse traditions. Taoism finds a place with yin and yang, legalism finds a place, the naturalist philosophies of the five phases all find a place, and of course, The one philosophy that's dominant in this mix is Confucianism. As the political situation changed, later thinkers reacted against the speculations of the Han Confucians, which tended to get somewhat wild. There was something called the New Text School, where those thinkers talked a lot about portents. They tended to write about Confucius as an uncrowned king. They almost deified him as a savior figure. And in a reaction against that, one of the key figures is named Wang Chung. He lives from 27 to 100 AD. He gives us an early Chinese example of rational skepticism. He was orphaned early on. He started school at the age of 8, however, but he was so poor that he couldn't afford to buy books. He had to read them in a bookstore. But eventually, he was given an opportunity to study at the Imperial Academy. He had a disappointing career, though, as a teacher and as a minor official. He wrote a book called The Balanced Inquiries. Okay, this is a fascinating text. It goes far beyond anything that Xunzi said. Remember, Xunzi said that heaven worked sort of mechanically and was against supernatural explanations. So also, Wang Chung says, heaven does not reward the good or punish the bad. In fact, heaven has no consciousness, no will, no perception. And even if it did, heaven wouldn't bother with people who are no more important in the big scheme of things than, and these are his words, than fleas in the garments of the universe. Everything just happens spontaneously and naturally. So Wang Chung is against what we might view as superstition. He rejects the yin-yang correspondences and the five phases cosmology. He doesn't believe in mythical animals like dragons or unicorns. He doesn't accept the significance of portents or divination or ghosts. Now he does accept reports of strange happenings. I mean, people see things, they hear things that are weird. And he says, that's true, people do see and hear strange things, but he thinks that those things have natural causes. I don't know that he's one of the great thinkers in this course. He's not quite influential enough, but he's just an interesting guy. So let me share with you the arguments that he makes against the existence of ghosts. He says, when people see ghosts, they tend to see one at a time. But if all dead people became ghosts, when you were able to see into that realm, wouldn't you see millions of ghosts? I mean, wouldn't the halls and the rooms be full of ghosts everywhere? And what about animals? Do animals have ghosts? And if so, wouldn't you see, I mean, how many animals have there been? He says, when people claim that they see ghosts, they seem to recognize them, right? It's a departed father or mother or a friend. He said, but there's no reason why ghosts should look like people, since a spirit in a body is something like rice in a bag. When the rice is let out of the bag, it just goes everywhere. I mean, so ghosts should actually be sort of amorphous. They shouldn't look like people. And then the last argument, which seems to me the strongest, is he says, why is it when people see ghosts, those ghosts have clothes on? Because even if spirits existed and survived into the next life, there's no reason to think that clothes have spirits that would go along with those deceased people. Hu Shi, and he's a 20th century philosopher, we're going to see much more of him in a later lecture. Hu Shi said that Wang Chung had a critical scientific spirit unique in Chinese intellectual history. Okay, unique is sort of a code word for it, not particularly influential. But he has been an inspiration in modern China. Wang Chung was one of the first Chinese philosophers, aside from Mencius and Confucius, of course, to have his works translated into English. And that happened in 1907. Because Confucianism was so closely associated with centralized rule, it was to some extent discredited when the Han Dynasty fell. Many scholars consequently turned to Taoism to make sense of the politically fragmented society in which they found themselves. And we call this movement Neo-Taoism. And it takes four forms, and all of these are found in the 3rd century AD. First, there were important commentaries written by Confucian scholars on the Tao Te Ching and on the Zhuangzi, which explored key concepts. So they said that non-action is not just doing nothing, but it's rather action that's natural and spontaneous. They said non-being is not just an absence of anything, but it's nothingness, which is actually something. I mean, it's the void from which the cosmos emerged. Now, those kinds of ideas are going to make possible later Buddhist-Taoist dialogue. The second form of neo-Daoism came from some educated men who withdrew from government service. Okay, remember the story about Zhuangzi saying that he would rather wag his tail in the mud than go be prime minister of the state of Chu. Okay, they're gonna copy that behavior, and they're going to withdraw from society, from government especially, and spend their time in witty conversation and poetry and music and disregarding social convention. The most famous of these was a group of men called the Seven Sages of the Bamboo Grove. One of them is famous for having a servant follow him around all the time, and the servant had a jug of wine in one hand and a shovel in the other, so that whatever happened to this guy, he could drink when he wanted to, and if he fell dead, his servant would just dig a hole right there and throw him into it. Okay, that's going to be shocking maybe to you. To Confucians, who care so much about ritual and especially funerals, that is just beyond the pale. There was another one of these seven sages who was famous for drinking stark naked in his home, sort of his private entertainment. Once a visitor came, was shocked by what he saw, and this sage said, "Heaven is my roof, earth are my walls, and my house is my pants. What are you doing in my pants?" Okay, now think what Mencius would have thought about this. Mencius was so offended when he accidentally walked in and his wife wasn't completely dressed. One modern scholar has described these seven sages as drinking themselves into a state of spiritual communion with the Tao. Okay, that makes it sound like hedonism, perhaps, but they're also rejecting Confucian ritual. They're deliberately trying to find another way, another path. There's a third kind of neo-Daoism, which is religious Daoism. There were some men called celestial masters who organized actually several competing movements with scriptures, like the Tao Te Ching became a scripture. They said that it was revealed by Lord Lao. That's going to be Lao Tzu. They believe in many gods. They arrange these gods into a celestial bureaucracy. There are priests and liturgy and rules of behavior for believers and rituals for healing and for forgiveness of sins through confession and good works. Okay, now sometimes this sort of Taoist church, these religious Taoists, are involved in peasant uprisings. The government wants to keep close tabs on them. And finally, the fourth kind of neo-Daoism is a search for immortality. People tried breathing exercises, yoga-like gymnastics, sexual practices, meditation, and alchemy. And now the alchemy is going to be similar to what we've seen in the West. They try to produce gold. They actually thought that artificial gold was more effective and powerful than natural gold. And they try to find the elixir of immortality. Now, they didn't discover the secret of immortality, but they did discover some medicines, some dyes, glazes, and perhaps ironically, gunpowder. So people who are looking to live a long time end up inventing gunpowder. The second great mind of this lecture is going to be medieval China's most famous alchemist. His name is Ge Hong, and he lives from 283 to 343. And he brings together several of these strands of neo-Daoism and then reconciles them with Confucianism. In fact, he almost sounds like two different people when you read his book. This book is called the Bao Puzi, and it means the master who embraces simplicity. It's a quote from the Tao Te Ching. And it's split into two parts. There are the inner chapters, there are 20 of those, and they're about the quest for Taoist immortality. And then there are 50 outer chapters, which are essays on government and contemporary social problems from a Confucian perspective. In the first section, Ge Hong describes a Taoist immortal. He says, "He is so high that no one can reach him, so deep that no one can penetrate to his depth. He rides the fluid light and whips space in the six directions. He crosses the watery expanses. He crosses the threshold of vastness." He's speaking about people who are so spiritually pure that they've been transformed so that they can fly, so that they can subsist on just air and dew, they can walk on water, and most importantly, they can live forever. Such perfected beings were mentioned by Lao Tzu and Zhuangzi in passing, but Ge Hong takes them quite literally. He says, "We've seen how caterpillars can turn into butterflies, tadpoles turn into frogs, people can turn into animals or trees." I know that's a little more questionable, but there are lots of stories of that. "Why can't people turn into immortals? I mean, just because you haven't seen them doesn't mean they don't exist." Now, I realize that that's an argument that you could use for unicorns and UFOs and all sorts of things, but Gehong is pretty serious about this. He offers practical advice for those, like him, who want to attain the rarefied state of a Taoist immortal. Do you remember Kuk Ding? He was from the Zhuangzi, that guy who could sort of look at an ox carcass and then cut it up so smoothly and spontaneously. If you combine that sort of naturalness with the five phases theories of how the cosmos works, then you get something that's going to lead into what Gehong is talking about. He says living in harmony with nature will lead to a long life. So you should reduce stress, you should be content, maybe practice some breathing exercises, some calisthenics. Okay, nothing like jumping jacks or vigorous. And more like slow, sort of controlled motions like Tai Chi Chuan. Avoid excess, he says. Don't eat or drink too much. Don't get overtired. Don't sleep too long. Don't abstain from sexual relations, but don't overindulge either. Okay, so is this good advice for living longer? Perhaps. But then he's going to take it to the next level. He says natural processes can sometimes be speeded along, sort of like dyeing fabric, that you can make this permanent change with a little help from chemistry. And he's going to recommend herbs and incantations and then some drugs as well. He gives detailed alchemical recipes of 27 elixirs that involve cinnabar, which was rich in mercury, and liquefied gold as well. Many alchemists at the time actually poisoned themselves as they were trying these things out. And what he's trying to do is recreate within his own body the longer-term processes of the natural world. Let's talk about his life now. Gehong is the only major Taoist who left us a personal point of view. The last chapter in his book is an autobiography, something like Sima Qian's last chapter. And somewhat surprisingly, for a Taoist, he's a pretty hardworking guy. I mean, he reads voraciously. He walks long distances to borrow books. He tells us that when he was young, he cut and sold firewood in order to buy paper and writing brushes. Gehong was living in the 4th century during this chaotic period between unified empires, between the Han Dynasty and then the Sui Dynasty that's going to come in the end of the 6th century. And during this time of social disorder, he's looking for control and security and stability. Gehong is a southerner. He's born south of the Yangtze River into a prominent aristocratic family. His father died when Gehong was 12, but he was still able to get a good education in both Confucianism and esoteric Taoism. At the age of 20, he was called on to organize and lead a militia against rebels, which he did quite successfully. That's actually pretty assertive for a Taoist. He belongs to these aristocratic families, and that was part of their responsibility, was to help keep order. For the next few decades, Gehong alternated between holding civil and military positions and then turning down such offices in favor of Taoist reclusion, like the Seven Sages. It was a time of political turmoil, kingdoms that came and went, dangerous times where people got killed who were involved in politics. In the second part of his book are Confucian essays, and in those he recommends that officials study widely, that they are appointed by examinations in the Confucian classics rather than by recommendations, because that's too subject to political connections. He wrote about the importance of laws and punishments with a touch of legalism in there. And then a remarkable autobiography in which he describes how unsuited he was to his times. He doesn't play politics. He doesn't visit officials. He doesn't try to cultivate useful friendships. He's unconcerned about his reputation. When he does good things, when he helps others, he tries to keep it secret rather than trying to parlay that into some sort of political clout. And he's unwilling to participate in corrupt dealings. In this autobiography, he writes this: honor, position, power, and wealth are like visitors, since they are not eternal things. And once they go, they cannot be retained. It's like the case of flowers in the spring, which necessarily die and fall to the ground. In attaining them, one is not delighted. Losing them, what sadness is there? Now, I know that I'm lazy by nature and extremely short on talent. Even if I were to be respectful and to go about on my duties, proceeding as quickly as the dust on the wind, I would not necessarily be able to achieve great fame and position or avoid sorrows and encumberments. How much more so is the case, since I cannot do even this? He combines Confucianism and Taoism. Doesn't entirely withdraw from worldly concerns, right? The Confucian ideal is to hold office when times are good and then retire when the government is corrupt. But he says that Confucian morality is the foundation for Taoist immortality. And you may have noticed in that last quote this sort of this humility, self-deprecation that's characteristic of Confucian virtues. One last quote. Those who seek to become immortals must regard loyalty, filiality, peacefulness, obedience, benevolence, and trustworthiness as fundamental. If one does not cultivate his moral behavior and merely instead devotes oneself to esoteric methods, he will never obtain an extended lifespan. Okay, did you notice benevolence and filiality, those Confucian virtues? Along with other Taoists, Gehong believed that one's moral actions had a direct effect on lifespan. So if you did something wrong, you would get 3 days taken off of your lifespan. And if you, in a major transgression, would cost you 300 days. And again, he gives very practical advice. He lists 64 possible sins, mostly Confucian vices that you ought to beware of. Chinese have often been Taoist in private and Confucian in public. And in part that's possible because thinkers like Gehong showed that it's possible to be both Confucian and Taoist at the same time, with the outer and the inner chapters. It's not like being either Jewish or Christian or Catholic or Protestant. In a similar manner, Dong Zhongshu showed how Confucian ethics could be compatible with cosmological speculations. When China is unified again in 581, we'll see how Taoism, Confucianism, and legalism all find a place within imperial ideology, though with a new addition, Buddhism. Strangely enough, even though the quest for Taoist immortality, right, to live as long as you can, and Buddhist enlightenment to escape from this existence, they seem like they're almost opposite, it turns out that Taoists and Buddhists in China have a lot in common, as we'll see in the next lecture.